Commençons cet après-midi avec une communication du professeur Wolfgang Ernst. Alors, professeur Ernst, typiquement, dans de nouveau les cadres de migration que j'évoquais ce matin. Je l'ai d'abord connu en Allemagne, puis il a migré, pour ainsi dire, en Suisse, et plus récemment, il a encore migré en Angleterre, tout en maintenant une très large perspective comparative, aussi bien dans le droit contemporain que dans l'histoire du droit, comme en témoigne d'ailleurs son livre récent sur les modes de décision dans les cours où il y a un collège de juges ayant à décider. Et c'est d'ailleurs, à ma demande, dans la prolongation de ce livre tout récent, publié en allemand, qu'il va nous parler cet après-midi. Je le remercie beaucoup d'avoir accepté mon invitation.
Ladies and gentlemen, in order to straight go in, would you please allow me to skip pleasantries as requested by protocol? It is obviously very pleasing and honorable to be here today. To go straight and in, there's no better way than to start with a bit of Roman law, namely the Roman law texts, one of the Roman law texts, which have accompanied the development of my topic throughout the centuries. The text is in the handout. It's a text which deals with a plurality of arbiters. Now, the structural problems of decision making in between multiple arbiters in an arbitral tribunal, as we would say today, and in a collegiate courts are very similar, and in fact the Roman law sources provide similar and identical statements as to multiple judges. Now, you have the text from the digest in the handout. It's an Alpian text, and it says that if the several arbiter deliver different awards, the parties don't have to abide with any of these awards. But if there is a majority at idem, then it is decided in the way the majority held. This is the view. You have two positive awards, one negative. The positive awards are in the majority. This is absolutely not surprising. It's just an application of the majority principle to the situation. The text now turns to a more difficult case in saying that out of three arbiters, or three arbiters give three awards over the sums of 5, 10, and 15 respectively. And the question is, what's the overall result? The parties to the arbitration agreement have to comply with. And the answer which is taken from Julian is 5. This is quite surprising. Intuitively, our approach today would probably not be to go for 5, but to go to a forced number, which we would take as, for example, the average or the median, which in this case would both be 10, because that seems to us to be the center of gravity of the three awards. And the decision which Alpian traces back to Julian, so we have, in a way, we have two of the very best names of the Roman lawyers, and we can't dismiss the finding as sort of superficially wrong or whatever. So there must be a good reason that Julian says this is 5, and he doesn't say it's 10. And the explanation, in my view, lies in a different concept of plurality of judges. The concept of multiple arbiters is basically a concept akin to having multiple consultations by medical doctors. You seek a second opinion and a third opinion, and you decide if these opinions are given independently. And you seek, you try to follow what is the overall result of these opinions. The modern concept of collegiate courts is that the judges or the arbiters of the arbitral tribunal, they cooperate and they bring in their opinions to generate a unitary judgment. The unitary judgment, by some process, results from the individual votes of the three judges or three arbiters. And the unitary judgment then could be 10 or could be established as a forced number. There's no unitary judgment resulting from the expert opinions, from the awards of the arbiters working on the same case in Roman law. And that makes it impossible to introduce a new average number into the process. There's no mechanism which would produce in real life this compromise number, the fourth number. So in fact, the situation for the Roman lawyer is basically you have three judgments, no majority in between these judgments, and so actually the case is not decided at all. And the solution brought in by Julian is to avoid the case being not decided at all and saying, well, I see common ground, the lowest common denominator is 5, and so we take it that there's an overall award of 5. As a warm-up operation, this text, I think, should show us the following. The getting together of a plurality of judges does not follow one model. There are different models in play for cooperating, having judges cooperate or decide the same case. And we have the Roman system to the left, and on the right-hand side, we have the more modern concept of a collegiate court, continental style. Now, after this warm-up, I would like to start the story proper by going into the 18th century. And the 18th century, actually the early phase of the French Revolution, we are going into the Assemblée Nationale in 1790. And I would like to introduce to you a person and his idea. The person is Adrien Dupont. Dupont was, we would say today, a man of the establishment. He was a lawyer born in 1759. He was a member of the Parlement in Paris, his main concern was the modernization of the judiciary. And on 29th of March 1790, he spoke in the National Assembly on modernization of the judiciary. And he developed a slightly complicated hypothetical, which I'm going to introduce in a moment, to set out his ideas of how collegiate courts should proceed in adjudicating cases. This is the hypothetical as discussed by Duport. It's about a claim which is pending before a 12 judges court. And the claim is brought against a person who is alleged to be the heir, and the basis of the claim is a claim which has accrued against the deceased. Now, there are two issues at stake. One is, did the claim in truth accrue? And secondly, the defendant objects by saying he didn't accept the inheritance at all. So the thrust of Duport's argument is that these two issues require two separate votations in between the judges. And he gives these numbers, saying that the claim against the deceased is approved by a majority of 8-4. And as to the matter whether the defendant accepted the inheritance, seven judges assume that the inheritance has in fact been accepted, whereas five are of the opposing opinion. So both requirements to come to a condemnation carry a majority. But the allocation of opinions in between the judges are so that only three of the judges, if asked individually, would give positive answers as to both issues. So what Duport does is he contrasts, he juxtaposes separate votations on the two issues to an integral votation asking each judge whether he would decide the case in the positive or in the negative. And if you go the way of an integral votation, then you have only three judges for positive judgment and nine for absolutio. And what Duport discovered here is that the voting design within the collegiate court is of crucial importance for the overall outcome of the case. That's the, for my story today, the historical importance of Duport in 1790. Now, I did not say, but hasten to say, that Duport had a very specific proposal in mind, namely the introduction of the jury system, or the import of the jury system from England to France. That was a key issue in the wish to modernize and the judiciary and to establish a proper rule of law. And the case is so designed, in his view, that the first issue is a matter of law and the second issue is a matter of fact. So he said we need to separate issues of law and issues of fact, and we have to, ideally, we give the matters of fact to the jury and the matters of law remain with the judges. Can I just make a footnote here? Among the friends of Duport was Nicolas de Condorcet. There's no need to say much about him, and you may have heard about the Condorcet cycle and other contributions to decision theory. Now, in the oeuvre of Condorcet, there is nothing pertaining to this specific problem. But Duport says in his statement, he has talked about the problem with Condorcet, and Condorcet has sort of given his mathematical blessing to the approach pursued by Duport. Duport was not he was not successful, only partially successful, in that while the jury was in fact introduced for criminal proceedings, there was no civil jury introduced in France. This is a civil law case. His idea was to have civil and criminal juries as well. Duport, in the second revolutionary phase, had to go underground. He was arrested, fled to England, came back to Paris, emigrated to Switzerland, and that's where he died. The French Code de Procedure Civile did not take up the idea of prescribing the vote, the individual or separate vote, successive vote on different issues. It does have, however, some helpful provisions on how to handle discord among the judges, but I don't want to go into these provisions at the moment. The lasting effect that came from Duport was the discovery that depending on how you design the voting process in the court, you can end up in different proceedings. And the question was, which is the best way to proceed? And it was in a different, with a detour and a slight delay, that the problem was taken up again in Geneva. I need to talk a little bit about the requirement of having reasoned judgments. It's a common knowledge that the Enlightenment time required judgments to be accompanied by arguments. Now that's not a totally accurate description of the historical process. Judgments have come with arguments all along. It's just that the arguments which supported the judgment were not given to the parties or not publicized, or not always. So a typical outlook in pre-Enlightenment times would be that you get the order of the court, the tenor or the dispositive, without any reasoning. But the votes which had been circulating in between the judges would all carry arguments one way or another. And what does change, in fact, in the 18th century is that people become convinced that judgments, being exercise of state power, should come with supporting arguments. And now that changes the majority finding exercise in collegiate courts, because while in the old Roman style system, you could just look at the end result. You now have also to merge the different arguments which come from the different judges. And let me just show you how that complicates the overall picture. You have a collective opinion or collective judgment that has structured deliberations, for example, of a procedural substantive matter, and you have these arguments which come in different. You have different arguments coming from different judges, and you somehow have to fuse these arguments so as that the collective opinion is supported by a cogent sequence of arguments which may be taken from one judge or the other. And that exercise makes the majority building much, much more complicated. And in the line of Duport, that problem was taken up by a man named Jean-François Bellot. Bellot was born in 1776. He was an attorney in Geneva, attorney and politician. Later on, he became one of the early professors. Once Geneva had regained its independence from France, a large-scale legislative process was started, and Bellot came into the situation that he could draft a modern civil procedure act. And that procedure act, also named the Loi Bellot, it is seen as the most advanced and most modern early 19th century procedural regulation. And in the handout, I have provided you with the Article 104, which requires judges to decide separately on both matters of fact and matters of law. So all matters of fact and all matters of law. This is not a jury system. This is a collegiate court system. All matters of fact and all matters of law which are disputed require a separate votation. This is linked to Duport's approach, only that Duport had sort of an institutional delineation in mind between jury and judges, and Bellot talks about the collegiate, the chamber of judges all together. Now, this discussion was taken up in Germany and given the German tendency to be both very theoretical and cantankerous. There was a huge academic discussion in Germany about whether the Bellot approach was the right one. I'm not going to set out how that discussion developed. I'm just looking at something which can be seen as the legislative hub for the discussion, sort of an end point in 1815. And that's the last person I would like to talk to you about. That is a man named Leonhard. Gerhard Adolf Leonhard, born in 1815. He was a career lawyer in the Kingdom of Hanover. And he drafted in 1850 for the Kingdom of Hanover, a Civil Procedure Act. And that Civil Procedure Act is of a high importance for not only for the Kingdom of Hanover, but for the pursuant German developments. And why is that? 1865, the Kingdom of Hanover suffered a hostile takeover by Prussia. It was dissolved, became part of Prussia. Leonhard, at that time, was Minister of Justice in Hanover. He became an official in the Prussian civil service, and in due course he became Minister of Justice in Prussia. And when, after 1871, the process started to introduce an all-German Civil Procedure Act, he was the key person to bring this about. And that's how his ideas from 1850 developed for Hanover easily made it into the German Civil Procedure Act. Now, Leonhard, in his motivation for the draft act of 1850, he says, let me tell you where I get this from. I get this from Geneva. And in fact, he had studied in Geneva, probably with Bellow. And he copied the Bellow provisions for the Hanover Act, and that's where other German legislators then looked in the first place. So this is basically how the ideas which started in Paris bore fruit in Geneva, were taken up by a German student who became Minister of Justice in Hanover and then in Berlin. That's what I mean by circulating ideas. Now, I would like to turn to the more technical aspect or micro level, asking how is this done, the voting on each issue. This in itself has been a topic of a heated debate. And let me just introduce to you three different models how this can be done. This is about alternative ways of letting each judge participate on each issue. This is the way, this is a hypothetical, this is the way Bellow had envisaged the process would go. You would line up the decision, the branches in the decision path. And by going down the branches, you would vote on each topic. Should the appeal be dismissed or granted? It's a contract case, so we decide, is the contract valid or invalid? Has the contract been broken? Has the contract been rescinded? These are issues which can be brought in a logical sequence, and you go with the full college of judges. You go from one voting point to another. There is one tricky element which has plagued the legislators, that you need to take the full chamber to the very last decision. That is, you have to take also the judges which have been outvoted on an early vote until the very end, because otherwise you lose the required number of judges for the full judgment. And there is a doctrine in the continental systems, which is the duty to continue voting stante conclusio. So you have to, as a judge, you are under duty to vote wherever you are in the decision path, even if you would say, I wouldn't be here in the first place, but I have been outvoted, you are under duty to continue voting. This is a typical signal that this is the voting procedure. Now, with some hesitation, I showed the second method, which I've been told is used in France, in the Cour de Cassation. And that is, you work out different pathways through the decision path. So, and you present the chamber with alternative pathways through the overall decision path. Path one, path two, or path three. And the rapporteur would present complete judgments, consistent judgments, which are based on a specific path. And then the judges would sort of pick like a sort of prefabricated or combined menus, menu one, menu two, menu three, whereas the idea by Belot is that every course is being picked successively anew. There's a third method, which is all these methods should result in the same outcome. You circulate a questionnaire. You first identify the contentious issues, and you let each judge say how he would vote on that. That's basically the same process as this one, except that you collect votes for stages which, in fact, may not be reached in the process. And then you know where the majorities lie, and then you can sort of, from the result of the questionnaire, you work back to the decision path, which is actually taken by the chamber. Now, I would like to use this communication to also look at the topic of dissenting votes. All over Europe, the judges, the permission for judges to supply dissenting votes is a highly contentiously discussed topic. And there is always people are pointing to the United States saying, or to England saying, you can see these are systems which work perfectly with dissenting opinions, and why not have dissenting opinions in our collegiate court systems? I'm not going to make a plea one way or another. I would just like to show how different the concept of dissenting vote in the Anglo-Saxon judicial systems and in the continental system is. We go back basically to Alpian. The Anglo-Saxon system allows every judge to give an opinion, to give a judgment of his own. He is entitled to establish or to determine the facts as he sees them established and give judgment for that. So the dissenting opinion is just the opinion of that judge who, in doing that, remains in the minority position. Now, you can fuse the majority judgments into one. You can call it the judgment of the court. But still, at the basis are judgments which are given individually by all judges. And correspondingly, all these opinions, which are on an equal footing, all opinions together make the judgment of the court. even though the order of the court only follows the majority of judgments, of opinions. This is just calling the opinions the majority and the dissenting opinion. Now, in the continental systems, the judges produce, they have a product coming out of their process, which is the collegiate judgment. All judges need to cooperate in order to produce that judgment. Their cooperation is a mediated one. It's not immediate giving the view, but it's contributing to the decision-making process. We've just seen that a judge cannot excuse himself by saying, oh, sorry, I've been outvoted, I feel the appeal should be dismissed, I go home now. That's not permissible. There's a duty to continue voting stante concluso. So all the judges, however, whether or not they are happy with the process altogether, are contributing to the production of the collegiate judgment. If we allow judges to also produce a minority vote, that would be, and is in fact in cases where it is allowed, is an additional text. In allowing dissenting votes in continental courts, we allow judges to take a double role. One is, and remains, contributing to producing the collegiate judgment, and one is sort of stepping outside the role of a member of the court and giving sort of separate view of mostly the legal side of the case. The judgment of the court remains the product of the chamber. That's the one which is being published. The minority vote typically is taken to the files, and in fact, historically, this has quite a long history in that it protects the judge against liability. And it's a debated matter whether the minority vote should be allowed to be published or not. So, this is a very brief a travel through circulating ideas in the continent and a brief look at the different concepts of collegiate courts on this side of the channel and on the other. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Wolfgang. This may have seemed sometimes perhaps a somewhat technical way of thinking, but well worth doing. In fact, next week, when I'll be discussing a case, a recent case, of the, well, recent 21st century case, but of the House of Lords still, just before it became Supreme Court, where actually one of the arguments of one of the litigants was not just looking, well, they look in a particular case, and they don't just look at the final decision, but it was a matter of cost, and they say, actually, if we look at the first instance and the appeal, and then the next appeal, we see that a majority of judges were actually for our client, even though the client has lost. So you can even complicate further the reasoning. But, of course, the real point of what you said was showing how a particular idea at the time of the French Revolution has been sort of making its way through Switzerland, through Belot, who has had major influence in thinking about civil procedure in the early 19th century, and we had of that a very illuminating example in Hanover. Of course, beyond that, it is true that it remains the fundamental difference between our continental systems and the Anglo-American system, where we switch over to, we see the switch sort of with dissenting opinions. Excusez-moi, je ne rendais pas compte que j'avais entre-temps, que j'étais passé à l'anglais. Il y a évidemment une culture juridique qui est à ce point-là assez différente. C'est le fait qu'on admet qu'il y ait toujours un débat qui se fait, même au niveau judiciaire. Donc cela, on peut voir, en d'autres mots, pour un juriste continental, que la décision, la res judicata, n'est pas remise en cause par le système anglo-américain, mais qu'il reste cette question de voir le débat. Et justement, pour l'appréciation, c'est un aspect que vous n'avez pas cité, mais que je, dans la poursuite de ce que vous avez dit, que je me permets de citer, c'est qu'évidemment, dans le système anglo-américain, on tient beaucoup compte des dissenting opinions pour savoir si, par exemple, on a une décision de la Supreme Court qui est de 3 contre 5, on sait que, en dehors des questions politiques, etc., on sait que la question demeure controversée, que c'est une question qui fait toujours débat, et que donc on peut s'attendre à ce que, à court ou à moyen terme, la même cause peut revenir de nouveau sur la Cour pour être revenue. Donc il y a une chose de parler en termes de res judicata dans l'affaire, ça n'est pas en cause en fonction de la majorité ou de l'unanimité, mais dans le système anglo-américain, la possibilité d'avoir des dissenting opinions qui sont exprimées dans le jugement permettent de poursuivre le débat aussi bien dans la doctrine que dans le monde judiciaire d'une manière qui est plus transparente, pour utiliser ce mot-là, que ce n'est dans le cas du continent.